Mr. Heron, Reel 6. Now, you just got into the water with your Dan boy from the Keith, which was settling slowly.
That's it.
And what was happening around you?
Well, there was masses of guys all swimming over. A lot of them, I understood, were heading towards the beach. Now, this is all information I gleaned afterwards. Not a great deal, but we were swimming. I swam to a tug, which was maybe a few hundred yards away. And I didn't have any difficulties with swimming because I'd obviously got rid of most of the gear that I had on. And we had time. There was time. It wasn't as panicky as the previous effort. And I swam to that, but I did see a lot of guys heading for the beaches, which I think was a bit silly, because their chances of getting killed on the beaches was equally as difficult as it might have been on the ship. Might as equally well have happened. So anyway, I swam to the boat. I remember distinctly trying to get. I hung onto the rubber tyres again. The rubber tyres were the great saving grace. And so I hang on to this tyre because the ship, the actual, it was a trawler. The trawler had actually started up, was underway.
So it wasn't a tug, it was a trawler.
No, it was a trawler, sorry. Wait a minute. No, tug was the right word, I'm sorry. Anyway, I hung on to these tyres on the side of it while the actual tug was underway. And it was getting quite speedy, and I was being dragged through the water at a rate of knots. And there was some stupid Matlow up above me who was saying, "Help this guy, push him up over the..." There was somebody above me who was hanging on to the edge of the thing. So I was trying to, one hand I was hanging on to the rubber tyre and the other trying to push this guy up so that he could, to help the guy pull him aboard. Anyway, not all this palaver, eventually we got aboard and we headed back towards Dover. We were being strafed all the time by German fighters.
What do you remember of that?
Well, I remember that we were all in our, you know, underwear or various dress, and we were all crowded on the deck of this thing. We were completely exposed, and I remember this, some officer, I don't know whether he was army, he was in his pyjamas for some weird reason, and he was standing up in the forecastle waving his arms over his head and saying, "Survivor! Survivor!" to the German, and they completely ignored any of this survivor business, and just but no, there wasn't. They didn't do much damage. I think there was the odd person killed on the tug, but it was very. They weren't doing very good. I think there were so many targets, they were almost at a loss to get some sort of organisation into their strafing. Because whatever they fired, they were hitting something or other.
Now, had you seen the ship go down, the Keith?
No, I hadn't. I was, to be honest, I was concentrating on getting myself back on board and getting away. Because we were in fairly shallow water. I mean, we were only, what? I suppose half a mile to a mile offshore. So, I mean, there was no distance. So whether the water was deep enough, whether it finally settled on, I don't really know, because we were away from the scene and I didn't really look back to see what had happened to the Keith.
And you were on, you were being struck. What happened next then?
Well, the next thing we went into Dover and just got off the tug, and we were all met by all the... the WVS and all that stuff. They were doing a great job feeding us and giving us drinks and tea and all the rest of it.
What state were you in? Because this was your second time. Were you all right?
Yeah, I was all right. I think I was better than I was in the first time, because it was daytime for a start when it when we finally got aboard the tug. The tug. And I don't think there was any... there was no great stress, actually, once we'd abandoned the... I mean, there was all this going on around us, but from a purely personal point of view, there was no great stress other than swimming and making sure I got aboard the tug. But I think I must, you know, in six, as you say, 60 years since all this happened, your memory is a little bit vague as to what was going on around you. But I think it's reasonable to say that mostly the story I tell is as true as I can remember it.
So what happened next? And it's more survivor's leave, I presume?
Yes, another 2 weeks survivor's leave.
And this this was much the same as your first?
Yeah, it was much the same. As I said before, I did tend to merge those two periods.
And it may be then that you met Szabo.
Szabo.
Szabo, sorry, yeah, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
But you're not saying which one it was?
Well, I'm pretty sure now that I'm talking to you, I think it's almost certainly must have been the second. The confusion, the reason I would like to know if I can place it more accurately is because I didn't know whether she was married or not at the time. And you see, she was captured just after D-Day. After D-Day. So that was some time ahead. So I don't think she was actually married at that time when I met her. I think she may have been just the local girl from Brixton and shop assistant, and must have... Although, no.
Correct. The name.
The name was the killer, because he must have been killed, but she must have been married at that time. He may have been killed or not in France. Probably with the German invasion. That's probably when he lost his life, I should think.
So, what was the next thing? Is this when you volunteered for special service, then?
Yes, during this time, yeah.
You were at Chatham?
I was at Chatham, yes.
And what made you volunteer?
Well, I was bored out of my skull, and the conditions weren't much different from when I first went back to the... barracks, and I just wanted to get out of anywhere, to get a draft somewhere. And I thought, you know, stupid as I was, I decided to volunteer for this job, which was, as you say, up on the notice board asking for volunteers.
And what was it? Where were you sent?
I was sent to Gosport, to HMS Dolphin, which was the submarine depot.
This is a shore station, then?
Yeah, it was a shore station.
What happened when you got there?
Well, you know, we were put through tests. There wasn't any training at that stage. It was just pure... And I remember... The only thing I remember clearly was the tank test, where they put you in with a submarine escape equipment... And you went at the bottom of the tank and did, you know, you're put through a valve system where your compressed air keeps you, and then you go finally into the tank, and you do an ascent through about, well, I suppose it was about 30 or 40 feet, I can't remember exactly, where by using your apron to... accelerate or slow down your ascent because of bends and the rest of it. But
how did you find it?
I found it all eye straight. I did suffer from some pain in my ears, and they told me afterwards that I couldn't stand too much of the water pressure, pressure, because apparently my ears, they're slightly different to the normal. It's just that they go this way or that way, the ear, not the lobes, but the actual internal section of the ear to the drum, eardrums, is slightly different. Anyway, that's what I was told. That
you haven't actually said what you were training for, because that was the point.
Well, I knew.
Or not training, but being tested for.
Tested for singles, one-man submarines. And that was, I didn't particularly fear going on work, because I knew nothing, because they weren't then in their, they were literally one-man submarines. They were you were riding a torpedo, basically, with a visor type affair in front of you, which kept you from the, and you were just towed in to as near as you could to the targets. For example, was it the Tirpitz up in Norway? You were towed in, then you could start the old motor, and in you'd go, cut your way through the nets. And anyway, I was very grateful that they had turned me down afterwards, because otherwise I wouldn't be here talking to you now, I'm sure.
Now, what was the next thing you remember then? Well, what happened as a result? You were rejected for that. Did you do any other submarine training?
No. I was rejected for that, and then I came back to barracks again, back to the old proverbial. And then I was drafted to Cyclops, HMS Cyclops, which was a submarine depot ship, up in the, it was in Rothsay, in the Isle of Bute, which was in the Firth. Is the Firth of Forth? Is that the Glaswegian?
I'm not quite sure where it is. I think it's the other one.
It was a wonderful spot. I had a wonderful time there because.
And you've been drafted as a telegraphist.
As a telegraphist, I think I was then. I don't know what I was. I may have been a Killick then in those days.
Leading seaman.
I think I was leading telegraphist then in those days. I'm not sure. I think I was. I'm not sure when I was made to a leading telegraphist.
And when did you join HMS Cyclops, roughly?
Roughly, let's see. 4 or 5 weeks after Dunkirk.
So the chest that got Dolphin hadn't taken long?
Oh, no, I was only there for a matter of days.
You think somewhere around July-ish?
Yeah, July-ish. I was drafted up to the HMS Cyclops, which was permanent base. It was a permanent submarine depot ship.
What did it do as submarine depot ship?
Well, it supplied. It did all the maintenance as the submarines came in out of patrol, off patrol. They were all the equipment was re-maintained and rehashed. Any repairs that were needed were done, and the Matlows obviously got a few days break.
Now, what was your job aboard the submarine?
Well, my job was looking after the electronics on the submarines, which was mainly the ASDIC systems and the.
Now, how come you suddenly knew about those?
Well, I didn't suddenly then. I don't think I had any training till I got to the Cyclops on the ASDIC. But, you see, once you're an electronics man, it doesn't take you long to get wised up on new equipment in those days, because it wasn't quite so complicated as it is now of systems of this, that, the other. It was either mostly... excuse me. It was mostly... actual amplification of signals of various sorts and the interpretation of that amplified system at the other end. When you came to get round to the bare bones of a communications or of any sort, I mean, after all, ASDIC through water is no different to transmission. It was very low frequency stuff.
I didn't know the submarines had ASDIC.
Oh, yeah, they had ASDIC against the ships and the other. You know, you hear these beep, 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 beep of ships going over the top. That was ASDICs. It's an underwater sensing of noises in the water. You actually hear the noises.
I knew that the destroyers and such had it. I didn't know the submarines had it.
Oh yes, submarines had it as well, Aztecs. It was vital to them if you were in an attack mine. Don't hold me as an expert on submarines, because all I was doing was maintaining, and in a very junior fashion, maintaining these equipments. I wasn't in charge of the maintenance, but Asdics, and of course the long wave, I mean the submarines in those days, main receipt, because they didn't transmit a lot, of course the main thing was not to avoid transmission as much as possible. The main reception was at 16 kilocycles, which was a big broadcast system from Rugby in those days, and still exists, I believe.
So you were repairing the Aztec, the wireless, anything else?
No, just that. And of course, I had various general jobs on board the Cyclops. For example, I remember I had to go to the top of the mast to, when one of the aerial had broken down, and out on the boom. That was a nightmare of a job, feeding the aerial through the block, and where the wire had sprayed out, and I was hanging on there like grim death, because at the time we were in dry dock. And if you've ever, the Cyclops anyway was an old-fashioned ship which was about 30 feet above sea level and when you're in dry dock you're another 30 feet, so then the mast on top of that. I was something like about 150 feet up, I should think, 150, even more, 200 feet up. But having been chased over the mark in St. Vincent for those times, it wasn't too bad. I wasn't afraid of heights, thank God. Otherwise, I'd have probably refused to go.
Any other jobs on the Cyclops?
Well, I was a very junior nerd. I suppose I had all sorts of... I can't remember exactly.
So you weren't a leading telegraphist there?
I don't think so. Now, thinking back, no, I think not. I think I got my... When I went... Because after this, I went...
Anything else about the Cyclops first?
No, it was a base ship. I liked... Rothsay was fabulous there. I mean, they had wonderful dance halls there. And it was a bit like Southend-on-Sea was to London in that era. It was a holiday resort for Glasgow. And the Isle of Bute was a beautiful place, and I had a thoroughly enjoyable social life there, which was a change after all the other chasing around like mad in my short spells ashore.
So how long were you with the Cyclops about?
I was, I'm not sure what date it was or month it was when I got drafted from the Cyclops to HMS Balder, heading for Iceland. I must have come back to Chatham, and I think then redirected to the Balder.
So we can look that up, and yeah. We'll pop that date in the cataloguing when it will.
Yes, right. The whole combined force went to Reykjavik. And it was a peaceful invasion, of course. There was no fighting involved.
Now, what was the Balder? What type of a ship was the Balder? Can you tell us about that?
The Balder was it was a sort of mixed-up thing, which I think it was originally a yacht of some sort. Anyway, I can't honestly describe the Balder. I can't remember it, because we only did the trip up from the UK.
You said it had a communications role. If you tell us about
that. Yeah, that was the thing. It was well equipped with transmitters, receivers, and a complement of telegraphists. And our major job was that the Navy was responsible for all communications for the whole force at that stage. And arriving in Reykjavik, we laid alongside and proceeded to do just that, was to spend our whole time communicating with the Admiralty. And via the Admiralty, obviously dispersing to the RAF and Army necessary communications.
So what happened when you got to Reykjavik? You said it was a peaceful...
Yeah, it was a peaceful invasion in the sense that we went alongside and after a day or two, I think, we went ashore and mixed with the local population, and it was a very friendly sort of atmosphere. What it was for was, of course, to act as a home fleet base in that area to protect, was to stop the Germans coming round the north of the, and having to go and going through into the Atlantic, or to have give us air cover and everything else from that, from the base in Iceland.
And what was your relationship like with the people, with the people, the Icelanders?
Very friendly. I had a wonderful time there. I always remember there was the big hall in Reykjavik was called the Odd Fellows Hall. It was part of the Odd Fellows, I think, which was a social club of some sort, a bit like the American Shriners and all those sort of things. A very nice time there. I met a couple of Icelandic girls, gorgeous. One of these girls was a spiritualist, and a practicing spiritualist or a professional spiritualist, whichever the term is. And she used to make things appear and ectoplasms shooting out all over the place. And she had a massive chair in the middle of her room where she did all this stuff. And below it were little things that you make, switches and all that stuff, which caused all this. And she actually got me to help her out by going down under this chair, operating all the mechanics of this stupid situation.
So it was all a con, this?
It was a complete and absolute con. And anyway, subsequent to that, I'll finish the story on her later, but subsequent to that, of course, I was sent off to on a sort of almost polar expedition to a place called Valfjord.
How do you spell that?
H-V-A-L, Fjord, F-J-O-R-D, I think. That's a
so you were detached from the Baldur?
Yeah, I was detached, and we went on. Rather interesting was we went under the command of Captain Marr, who was a member of the Shackleton's expedition. I think the name that it was spelled M-A-R, and we were right. You, and you. You know, it was one of those volunteers. We will go up and on this expedition. They wanted a communications plane, so I went up with a pack on my back, you know, a wireless pack on my back, and they equipped us with a thing called a truple coat, which was a diabolical thing that it weighed about half a ton. And was all waxed and, you know, and was as rigid, so that we were walking like penguins, waddling along. So eventually we threw those out and got some leather jerkins, which were more like. And then we were equipped with skates and short cross-country skis. And none of us, except Ma, I think one other, had ever been on anything like this, any sort of Arctic expedition. So, I mean, we were almost killing ourselves on these skis. But after a while, you know...
So you were actually meant to be skiing?
Oh, we were supposed to... Well, yes, because it was. We were crossing complete... There were no roads. Well, there were roads, but where we were going in Valfjord, it was a cross-country hike, about 50 or 60 miles up from Reykjavik. And the idea was we were going up to Valfjord to open a controlled mining system for the home fleet, because of Valfjord itself. Fjord was a wonderful base, would have made a wonderful base. Whether it was ever developed fully, I don't know. But we were there to open this controlled mining, and there was a Nissen hut way out on the point at the mouth of the fjord. And the idea was we were stringing magnetic loops across to detect submarines, and if a submarine was coming through, there were mines that would blow up control. They called it controlled mining system, and they would blow up the submarines if they came in through the mouth of the fjord.
How did you actually go about doing this?
Well, I didn't see, to be honest with you, I didn't see much of that side of it. All I was doing was the communication side. But I know we had a pretty frightful time getting up there. That was the most impressive part as far as I was concerned.
Tell us about the journey out there.
Oh, the journey was frantic. I remember we got to one stretch of water. It was there during the winter. The actual ice was frozen so you'd come, you'd be marching, going across the snow on your skis for a stretch, and then you'd come to this where you couldn't use the skis on this ice because you'd be breaking your damn neck. So what we used to do was we'd get skates on and skate across, and I hadn't skated in my life. And there was one guy who was demonstrating, fancied himself as a skating expert, and he was demonstrating to us how we were to get across these stretches of ice. And he said, look, you do this, and he launched himself out on the ice, but he'd forgotten they'd given us racing skates, and racing skates have enormous teeth in the front of, well, like big teeth in the front of the skate, and he'd inadvertently put his foot up a bit, and this bit, and he did a complete circle and landed flat on his face, knocked out two or three of his teeth actually in the process. So that was the end of the teaching, and we struggled across on our skates across this areas and back on the skis again. It was a bit of a farce actually.
What was the weather like?
Well, it wasn't too bad, if I know. I mean, everywhere was snow, of course, but actually our period, I mean, I don't think it took us about 3 or 4 days, I think, to get up to Valfjord. We were travelling fairly fast for inexperienced people, but I think once you got to grip with these short skis and you got the motion right, it wasn't too difficult.
And what was Captain Marr like? Just 1 hour, was it?
Yeah, I think it was... Ah, now you've got me. 1 or 2 hours. But I'm sure that's well documented.
What was he like? He must have been getting on a bit by then.
Yeah, he was. Yes, he was getting on. I don't think I can remember his age, but I think he must have been in his 50s. Something like that. I don't think we ever questioned him. I think we were too busy getting across the snow and ice.
What was he like?
But he was a very nice guy. Very, not at all authoritative at all. He was, he sort of mucked in and got us all on route successfully. I was quite impressed, actually. But then he disappeared when we got the other end, and we got into the Nissen hut. And we drove away from that camp to an army camp and got as drunk as lords there on one occasion. It only happened about once during the time.
What was the conditions like in the Nissen hut?
Oh, diabolical.
Why?
Because the same that happened subsequently was that these Nissen huts, all right, shell round, one big boiler in the middle, and there, but all the ends were wood, and the wood, either by design or because they had warped, there were big holes in the end of the hat. So if the snow blew in, you finished up with your face covered in snow from the following morning, waking up with having to crack your face before. Perhaps I'm exaggerating slightly, but it was pretty primitive.